Paper Section. Thank you guys all for coming. I'm Hannah, this is Rob, and we're going to work with you for the next hour and a half. So a couple quick, this is also more comfortable. So if you wanted to see less comfortable, that was the last hour and a half, and you can watch that online. Yeah, cool. So a couple quick logistics. Number one, sections. A lot of people have still not filled out the sectioning form. So if that applies to you, please go through your emails, find the one from Professor Malin, and make sure that you section and fill out that form. By the end of this week, we'll be sending you out an email that says what section, what TF you're assigned to. Number two, office hours. This coming week, as all weeks, we will have office hours Monday through Thursday, 9 to 12 a.m. Okay, that's all.
Okay, so for those watching on video, you're really missing out. There's quite a crowd in here. So we're going to repeat some stuff from the prior section if you weren't there, but we'll go pretty quickly through stuff that was in the less comfortable section. So first, we'll talk through the IDE real quick. So IDE stands for Integrated Development Environment, and the idea is just sort of everything you need to do your development is in this one location. So last year we had the CS50 appliance, which was a virtual machine that was sort of the way we standardized everyone's working environment. Whether you had Windows or Mac or Linux, you just used the CS50 appliance and we could help you. So this year we're transferring to an online tool called Cloud9. And so if you just head to cs50.io, so cs50.io, and then log in there, you'll be brought to something that looks like this, where I will increase some font sizes. Let's clear that. Okay, so this is the CS50 IDE, and it's in this that you're going to be doing all of your work. Now, since this is not the less comfortable section, the absolute first thing I'm going to do is go into this menu, go to Preferences, and turn off Less Comfortable Mode. So the only reason to do that is if you want to see some more options up here. Now you have full access to any of the options you might want to see in the IDE. You may or may not ever use them throughout your time in the course. So Davin mentioned in the prior section that I have a preference for using Vim, which is another text editor. Now, if I wanted, I could use, let's create a new file, hash include standardio.h, I don't know, that's fine for now, and hello.c. Okay, so if I wanted, I could use this text editor, and it's perfectly fine if throughout the semester you use this text editor. For me, and I just learned this, they have a very convenient, now that I've turned off less comfortable mode, if I go into edit, I can go into, keyboard mode, and maybe use Sublime Text. So they also have a Sublime Text keyboard mode, and they have an Emacs and Vim mode. So if I wanted, I could enter Vim mode and now use all my convenient Vim shortcuts in here. But instead, throughout this, I'm going to just use the terminal version of Vim. And so Davin pointed out in the prior thing that he types clear to clear the window every once in a while. You can also use, if you're on a Mac, Command K. I imagine that there is an equivalent alternative on Windows within this, or Control L also clears things. So I will be doing that pretty frequently, and I will also increase this more. Though that's preventing me from doing that. So view, terminal font size. Oh, that's going to take forever. There we go. Oh, now that I did it once, it's letting me. Okay. So, how's that look for everyone? Let's full screen this. Oh, I forgot it hijacks my, darn it, that also hijacks my keyboard shortcuts. How do I full screen if not? Okay, I can do that. I'm used to just command entering being full screen. Okay, so I'm going to work within here and just use Vim. You don't have to use Vim throughout the course. You are free to use that terminal editor or that code editor that's given to you. The nice thing about Vim, as Davin was saying earlier, that every computer, every machine you ever go to, literally ever, will have Vim on it, or at least VI, which is the earlier version of Vim. And that means that, you know, every once in a while, my advisor will say, hey, do this on this random machine over here, and she gives me some IP address that I'm just supposed to work with. So if I SSH, well, we'll see SSH in a second, possibly. I don't know if you can SSH on Cloud9. Ignore that. But I access this computer, and I'm not going to have a nice GUI text editor. I only have a terminal access, and so I use Vim on that. And like, if you take further courses, you will want to learn one of these text editors. So Vim, now I can Vim hello.c. It'll open up hello.c. Now, first thing to note is that if you're following along and you have just opened this, you can always manage to get out of Vim if you hit escape and then colon Q enter. So a lot of people manage to get stuck in Vim and then don't know how to exit Vim. You can always do that. If it tells you that, I don't know, if we make a change to the file, how we're going to save is colon WQ, save and quit. Okay, otherwise I'm just going to be using this, and if you want to look further into how Vim works, you're free to. Okay, so we're going to talk through some of those terminal Linux commands that you might have seen in the previous super section. So first thing, cd. So cd is how we're going to change directory, and we're going to combine that with, I'll quit Vim. So ls is the way that we can list the contents of a directory. Directory is synonymous with folder. If I want to make a directory, mkdir, make directory, and I can make a directory pset1. So now if I list, I see that I have a pset1 directory. The nice blue syntax highlighting indicates that that's a directory. I can use cd for change directory to cd into pset1. So now I'm inside the pset1 directory. As we can see over here, that indicates our current location. So I'm in the pset1 directory. Now some tricks, cd dot. Dot always refers to the current directory, and so cd dot would cd me to the same directory I'm already in, so that's a meaningless command. Cd dot dot. Dot dot always refers to one directory up. So since I'm in the pset1 directory, one directory up from that is the workspace directory. So cd dot dot, and now we see that I'm in a workspace. If you wanted a more explicit way of seeing exactly what directory is you are in, you could do pwd. That stands for print working directory. And I see that my full directory is slash home slash Ubuntu slash workspace. And that should give you an indication that this tilde, that is shorthand for my home directory, and my home directory must be slash home slash Ubuntu. And that tilde can be used in other places. So if I want to cd to my home directory, I can say cd tilde. And now I'm in, if I print working directory, I'm in slash home slash Ubuntu. And finally, I'll make some directories just to give an example. Make dir foo. Oh, actually, I mean, I almost literally never use this, but dash p, I'm pretty sure, will allow you to make a whole bunch of directories in case you ever need to make like a nested list of directories. So foo slash bar slash baz. So now if I look in here, there's a delay on my typing. I can go into foo, I can go into bar. And another handy note that some people don't realize, there is tab completion here. So if I do cd tab, the only directory in this directory is baz, so it'll autocomplete baz for me. I can also, so dot dot slash dot dot slash dot dot will bring me up three directories, so I'll end up back in the pset1 directory. So I can also just cd foo, hit tab, it'll complete it, tab bar, tab baz, and I'll cd all the way through that. You don't have to cd into one directory, then cd into the next. You can do it all at once. So the last semi-useful cd command. So now I'm in foo. If you do cd dash is the last directory that you were in. So the prior directory I was in was foo bar baz. So cd dash will bring me to foo bar baz. At this point, if I do cd dash, it's going to bring me to foo again. Because once I cd dash into foo bar baz, the prior one was foo. So cd dash just sort of toggles between those two directories at this point. You can't use cd dash to like It doesn't keep a full history of all of the directories you ever CD'd into. You only have the prior one and your current one. Okay. And ask any questions at any point, because you know we haven't gotten to a lot of material yet. Once we get to more material, there will be a lot more opportunities for more comfortable stuff to be talked about. But ask any questions about anything, and we can dive into it. So next, we talked about makedir. Move, to talk about real quick, MV. So move can move any file or directory throughout the file system. So I can move bar up one directory. And now if I cd up one directory, I see that bar and foo are in the same directory. And if I look back into bar, bar still has the bats directory inside of it. So bar and all the contents within bar were just moved up one directory. Okay. Now rm. So rm is how we remove things. Technically, there is a remove dir. So if I want to remove a directory, if I do rm baz, it'll say cannot remove baz. It is a directory. So the, I don't want to say it's the correct way, but the command that exists for this is rm dir. Just like there was make dir, we have rm dir, remove dir. And we can use that to remove baz. Now there's a problem with remove dir. Let's make baz again. Let's go into baz. Now touch is a very simple command that just creates a file. So if I touch hello.c, now the file hello.c exists. The other purpose of touch is you can set the timestamp of a file. So right now hello.c, oh, another one, ls-l. That lists full details about the file. So we'll learn more about what a lot of this means, but this indicates that the file is owned by the Ubuntu user. It's in the Ubuntu group. The permissions on this, I'll just tell you that the Ubuntu user is able to read and write this file, but no one else. Maybe you want a file in the file system that some other user can use. But currently, only the Ubuntu user can read and write to this file. So if we look here, this file was last modified on September 13th at 2052. I'm not good at military time. But if I touch hello.c again, we see that it'll update the time. Is it still 2052? If I waited like a number of seconds and then touched it again, at some point it'll 2053. Okay, so that's what touch does, just creates a file or updates the timestamp of a file. It's not that important of a command line function. But I use that just to create hello.c. And the point of creating hello.c, if I go back one directory and try to remove baz, I get rmdir failed to remove baz, directory not empty. So rmdir can only remove a directory that is completely empty. That means I could go into baz and remove hello.c explicitly using rm. So go into baz, rm hello.c. It's going to ask me to confirm, remove regular empty file hello.c. Yes. And now I could rmdir baz, but touch baz hello.c. Actually, a nice opportunity for another little command line trick. So touch baz, I don't know, foo, touch baz bar. In case you've never seen these terms before, they tend to be the default words for in computer science, foo, bar, and baz. If I just need to come up with some random word for something, it will be, it, by default, I will choose foo, because it's an easy throwaway word. So now I don't need to do touch, like what if I wanted to right now create 10 files, baz, foo, one, or baz, in the baz directory, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, files called 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I don't have to say touch baz 1, then touch baz 2. Though a nice convenient thing that you might also not know, you can press up and down arrow keys in order to scroll up and back and forth in your history. So it does keep track of that history. So I don't need to do that 10 times. So bash, another term. Bash is this terminal environment that I'm working in. Bash is the shell that I'm currently using. So there are alternatives to bash, but bash tends to be, I think, the most common at this point. So a nice another bash trick is you can use curly braces where Touch might not let me do this. Let's see. That's okay, so all the files are created. So what the curly braces do is they expand to, so as another example, I could say remove baz curly brace 1, 2, 3. And that'll ask me to remove 1, ask me to remove 2, ask me to remove 3. So what curly braces do is they expand the argument. So technically, this was the same thing as saying baz 2, baz 3. I frequently also use this in places where if we have both a .c file and a .h file, I might say, you'll see check 50 later, but I don't know, some random 2014 or 2015. I don't know a good example. PSET1 Mario. Then I might say like PSET1 Mario. If there were multiple files, this would be more relevant. Mario.c, Billo.c, Greedy.c. So that's a way that I could, that would expand to PSET1 slash Mario.c, space, PSET1 slash Hello.c, space, PSET1 slash Greedy.c, instead of needing to type all that out. That said, many people go many years without realizing this, that this exists, these curly braces. So you don't need to remember all of these things, but it's kind of nice to like see them once and then remember at some point in the future, like, man, I don't want to keep typing this thing. Oh yeah, I remember something like this exists, and then maybe you ask about it or look it up or something.
Even though you're in Vim, we can still do this.
Right now I exited Vim. Vim, it would strictly be for code editing. This is just the terminal. Yeah. Whenever I want to edit something, I will go into Vim. Okay, so purpose of creating all those files is now if I want to go into baz, I would need to remove all of these files before I'm allowed to remove baz. That's the whole purpose that rm-r exists. So it recursively, and so if you don't know what recursively means yet, we will talk a lot about recursion later, but recursively means that, let's say we had a in the baz directory, we had a foo directory, within which we had a bar directory. So recursively would say, just keep descending into the directories to remove everything. So rm-r baz is going to ask me to descend into the baz directory. It'll ask me to remove everything explicitly in the baz directory. And then finally, it'll go back up and say, now do you want to remove the baz directory? Now that's annoying, especially if you had a ton of files in the directory. So that's why if I do rm-rf, f just means force, and this will blindly blow away everything that's in the baz directory, and now the baz directory is gone. So this is mostly why the rmdir command is pretty much useless. Most people just use rm-rf to remove any given directory. Now you gotta be careful with that because, I mean, there are horror stories. I have done this where, like, you accidentally do rm-rf tilde. So now I just blew away my home directory. So everything in it would just be gone. Even worse is rm-rf slash. So if you're not familiar with this, slash indicates the root of my file system. So in Windows, you would see this as like C colon slash or whatever it is. And in Macs, it would actually also just be slash. So removing the root of my file system removes literally everything. So if I did this, I actually don't know what would happen. In a lot of cases, actually this would probably not let me because the Ubuntu user does not own the entire file system. But there's a lot of danger here, especially, I have done this before. Like it's especially easy. What if I wanted to remove slash workspace slash pset1, but I accidentally, I accidentally did this. So now it'll remove my entire home directory and say it couldn't find the slash workspace slash pset1 directory. So again, be careful with rm-rf, but I'm not going to lie to you. I use it all the time to remove things. Okay, other commands. We saw touch, man. So man is how you look things up in the manual, the man pages. And so take any given function. Remove that. So take any given function or even any given command. So if I wanted to look up the cd command, I could say man cd. Okay, can't do that. Man ls. So cd is a special thing built into the shell and not an actual program. But ls is a program. So ls, we see that, oh, it's a, the name is ls, it lists directory contents. How do we use it? It gives us a description. It gives us all of these flags. So a lot of command line functions take flags. So ls-l, you're passing ls the dash l flag. There tend to be full names for these things. So dash l presumably also has a full, I'm searching for it. There are a lot of flags that go to the ls. Dash L doesn't have one. But some of these, you'll see that I could say either dash N or dash dash numeric dash UID dash GID. So that would just be like the full name for the flag, or you can just say dash N. But there are a ton of flags here. If you ever want to figure out if LS can do something, as another example, like LS dash L. OK, so this just displayed foo. But that is not every single thing that's in this directory. If I do LS dash AL, I now see that there's a dot and dot dot entry in this directory, where we already know dot refers to the current directory and dot dot refers to the previous directory. If I go back to another handy default for cd, I'm just throwing everything at you. You don't have to say cd tilde to go back to your home directory. You can just say cd and it will automatically bring you to your home directory. So now if I do ls-al in here, I see a whole bunch of files. So we see .gitconfig, gitignore, hgignore, hgrc, .mysql underscore installed, all of these dot files. So dot files are hidden from ls by default. That's why I use dash a in order to view them. So we don't want to pollute our entire home directory with all these files that we would see every time we do ls. So if I just do ls, I see the directories I want. But if I want to look at everything that's in this directory, dash a will show it to me, al will show it to me. And if you wanted, you could say man ls, and then look at right here, it says dash a, do not ignore entries starting with dot. Okay? Questions about anything? Okay, so then grep. Grep is another useful command that, let me make some test files. Okay, I'll remove foo. Now, I'll make a hello one, where this is gonna have just say cat, dog, fish. I'll make a hello two that just has the contents cat, dog. And I'll make a hello three that has the contents fish. Okay, so what is grep? Well, the easiest way you can answer that question is to man grep. And we see here that it says grep searches, and okay, I will admit that a lot of times the man pages are not particularly dumbed down. They can be difficult to find examples of things, so I tend to use Google as well to look up what a lot of these things are. But grep searches the named input files or standard input if no files are named, or if a single hyphen minus blah blah, four lines containing a match to the given pattern. So if you worked through what that means, I'll just give an example. I can say something like grep for cat in star. So another bash thing is this star. Star indicates anything that matches a given pattern. So if I wanted to ls, let me check that this works first. Okay, yeah. So I want to list every file in this directory that begins with hello, and then star is just wildcard. It'll match anything. So it's printing hello one, hello two, hello three, since all of those have hello at the beginning. Now if I wanted to ls all things that had, I don't know, lo in the middle of them, that would still list all of them. If I wanted to ls everything that ended in one, that would just print hello one. So if I just do star, that indicates print or match on everything. So grep now, if I want to search for cat across all files in this directory, it will tell me that cat is in hello one and hello two. If I were to search for dog, that's also in hello one, hello two. If I search for fish, that is just in hello one and hello three. Yeah?
How do you exit
Yes. So exiting Vim. If I'm in hello one. So if you've managed to get yourself into insert mode, which there are a couple ways of doing that, but if I type I, now I'm able to type actual characters. So if I'm in insert mode, to exit insert mode, you can press escape. If you don't know what mode you're in, just keep pressing escape and you'll get back to the normal mode of things at some point. So keep pressing escape, and then at this point, you can do colon Q and then enter to exit if you haven't changed anything. If you have changed things, either colon Q exclam will discard all changes and it's basically exit without saving, whereas colon WQ is save and quit. W stands for write, so write the file and quit. So now we're out of Vim. And now if I grep for fish, we'll see that it's only in hello 3 since I just modified hello 1 to change fish to whatever that long string was. Okay, so grep is very useful for trying to find, especially if you have like a whole bunch of files in your code base and you want to find which file defines a given function, then you can grep for that function name to find it. And finally, we have this less than, greater than, and pipe. Now, similar to the curly braces and the star, these are things specific to bash, but they're very useful. And most other shells have an equivalent. So if I, what's a good example? Okay, so I'm trying to think of a non-trivial example for these. Okay, so if I, another command just to throw at you is cat. So cat, if I do cat hello one, that just prints the contents of that file to the output. I don't know what cat stands for. Concatenate files and print on the standard output. Okay, so concatenate, if you haven't seen that term before, it's the term for combining a whole bunch of strings together. So if I said cat hello one, hello two, it would print the it would concatenate the contents of hello one and hello two and print them to the screen. So now, what if I wanted to save this output to a file? So what I can do is this greater than symbol, that's redirecting the output from the screen to a file. So I call this hello4. I will now see that I have a file called hello4. Nothing was printed to the screen. And if I cat hello4, I see the contents that I would expect to be in hello4. Everything that the command would have outputted is now in the file hello4. Okay, now, what is a good example for piping in? Or for the other one? Let's make a very contrived example for this. So, test.c. CS50.h, int main void. And now I'm going to, it froze on me. There we go. Okay, int x equals get int. So remember that in the CS50 library, there is a, actually I'll also print a message that we see enter an integer. CS50 library, getInt will prompt the user to type in an integer, and then we will print out what that integer was. You entered %i. There's also %d, but the course uses %i. X. Okay. So let's run this program. Make test, ./test. Enter an integer, I'll enter 5, you entered 5. Okay, so why did I create this silly little program? I wanted to give an example. Now let's say I have a file with the contents, I'll call the file 5, and all it will have in it is the number 5. So now, if I run ./test, without doing anything else, this will expect me to enter an integer from standard in. Standard in is your keyboard. So you'll hear that term more, but standard input is generally your keyboard. So instead, if I do dot slash test and redirect standard in to the file, not test, to the file 5, enter an integer, you entered 5. Okay, so what happened? Instead of standard in coming from my keyboard, this redirected standard in to be the file 5. So the file 5 has the contents of the number 5. And so when it asked me to enter an integer, it didn't take it from the keyboard. Instead, it took it from the file, it read from the file, and it got the 5. So if I instead change the file 5 to say 10, then the file name is not particularly descriptive, but dot slash test and pipe in 5, and it says you entered 10. So it's a relatively simple way of reading from a file instead of the keyboard. So now remember that, what was the prior one we used? So the greater than took the standard output and put it into a file, whereas the less than sign took a file and put it into the standard in. And the last one, the pipe, is a way of sort of doing both things. So now, what's a good example of piping? I should have come up with this beforehand. Okay, so let's say, what? Oh, perfect. Okay, so let's say I want to count how many files are in a directory. So I will, oh, we already have a good number of files in here. I could make some more if I want. So now we want to see how many files are in this directory. There's a handy dandy function called wc. If we did man wc, we'll see that this prints a new line word and byte count for each file. So wc stands for word count. If you looked further at the man page, we would see that wc-l counts the number of lines. So this is currently expecting input from standard in. So I don't, if I type a whole bunch of stuff, and then, what is it, control D? Yeah, so this output 4. So I entered 4 lines. Now if I instead do wc-l of hello 4, it output 5. Because hello 4, if we look at it, it has 5 lines. Okay, so how can we use this? Well, if I want to count all of the files in the directory, first thing I can do, ls-l returns lists all of the file, each one on one line. So ls-l, now I can output that to a file called, I'll call it foo. And now from word count, I can count all of the lines in the file foo. It will do 13. Now remember that if I just ran wc-l, it expected things from standard in, which is just the keyboard input. So it expected things from standard in. That means that I can also run it doing this. So now instead of it expecting things from my keyboard, it's just reading from that file instead. So foo had 13 lines, wc-l reading from the file foo got 13 lines. Now notice I needed this temporary file. So if I do ls-l into foo and then wc-l from foo, well, now what will this return? Okay, wait, I didn't expect it to be 13 that time. The reason I didn't expect it to be 13 is because I thought the file foo had been created, so now it would add that file, but the file foo had already existed, so we don't need to worry about that. So ignoring that, notice I need this temporary file foo, which is kind of a hassle that, like, okay, I created the file foo from the output of ls. Now I'm reading the file foo into wc, and now what am I going to do? I'm just going to remove foo. I didn't need it for anything except to pipe into wc. So the handy dandy way of doing this without creating a temporary file like this is the pipe, the bar, and that's what's immediately above your enter key, typically. So if instead I did ls-l piped into wc-l, it'll immediately give me 12. 12 now that I removed foo. So this is just shorthand for take the output of ls-l and make it the input to wc-l. And I think you'll see this in later places in the course. But these redirections, especially this one, the greater than to output into a file, I use this all the time. Questions about these? All right, again, it's nice just to see all of them, and then as you like, as you're going through the course and you think, oh, it would be useful if I could do this. Oh wait, this is familiar, I can do this, and then you can look it up or something. But just to get a nice overview of what all of these things are. Okay, that's it for Linux commands. I'll take over for a bit.
Alrighty. So we're very quickly going to go through a bunch of topics that are covered in more depth in the less comfortable section. So if I say anything that seems a little bit confusing, I'm just going to run through these. If there's anything in particular you want to go over more, shoot your hand up or check out the less comfortable video online. So we remember variables from our Scratch programs. We have the same thing in C. We have to give them a type and a name. A couple things to keep in mind when you're naming your variables, give them reasonable names, things that when I look at them, I'll be able to tell what kind of information they store. But in situations like if you're using a variable for a loop, you can just use a single character like I. That's totally fine. Cool. So in Scratch, we encountered a number of different loops. And similarly, in C, we have a number of different loops. So we have four loops, which have three parts that you need to keep track of. First, the initialization, which usually looks something like int I equals 0. So it's what we do before we start the for loop. A condition, which says, OK, as long as this condition is met, I'm going to continue running this for loop. And an update, which says, after every time I run this loop, I need to change something in some way. So here's a quick example. In Scratch, we saw this called repeat. In C, it's called for. You can check these out in more depth later. All right, we also have something called while loops. So this would be like the forever block in Scratch. And all this does is you say while, and then you have a condition. And the computer is going to check that condition. So long as that condition is true, the code inside the loop will run. OK, do while loop is super similar, except it always, and also side note, these slides are going to be online. So don't worry about rushing to get it all down. So do while loops will first execute the body of the loop before it checks the condition. So this is super useful when you're trying to get input from the user because, for example, say that you want to get an integer from the user, but you only want positive numbers. It wouldn't make any sense to use a while loop because you haven't gotten a number the first time you check it. So instead, maybe you'll have a do while loop that repeatedly prompts the user and then checks if they've given a positive number. Any questions up until this point? Going super fast. All right, awesome. Oh, sorry, I thought I heard your question. All right, cool. So yeah, this is the example I just described. Oh, and one thing just to keep in mind here is notice that input has to be defined outside of the scope of the while loop. Otherwise, we won't be able to check it over here or use it beyond the loop. All right, cool. We're going to jump really quickly into conditions and Boolean expressions. So these are things that you saw in Scratch. Quick note over here, see how there's one equal sign in Scratch? In C, when we're doing equality comparisons, it's always two equal signs. So for example, we could have something like if, where we just want to, let's say, check if an integer is greater than 0, and then print something as a result. So that might look like this. We can add an else, which says, OK, either. So if n is greater than 0, print. You picked a positive number. Otherwise, that's the same thing as else. Otherwise, and else are equivalent. You picked a negative number. Cool, and we might even expand that a little farther with if, else. So this will say, OK, if the number is greater than 0, you picked a positive number. If it's less than 0, you picked a negative number. And otherwise, you pick 0. And realize that at most, one of these pieces of code can run. So it's either going to fall into this category, or this category, or this category. Hopefully you can see your mouse, so you know what I mean when I say this. All right, cool. Any questions? Awesome. All right, one more type of structure that we want to learn. So for example, let's say we want to pick a number between 1 and 3. And we want to check, OK, maybe it's 1, maybe it's 2, maybe it's 3. So you could have a bunch of ifs and else ifs in order to check this, and that would be totally fine. But a slightly cleaner way to do it is something called a switch statement, which we can use whenever we're looking at the value of an integer. So here we say, OK, we're going to get the integer from the user. And then we have a bunch of different cases depending on what the integer is. So you'll see case 1, which is the case in which n is equal to 1. And this is what we want to do if n is equal to 1. And then this keyword break over here says that, OK, we found what we wanted to do. Jump out of this. Oh, whoa. Jump out of this switch statement and don't do anything else. If we don't have that break in there, it's going to try each of the cases before it exits the switch statement. And of course, down here we have a default, which is, OK, if it doesn't fall into any of the cases that we specified, this is what you should do in that case. Alrighty. Oops, I lied. We had one more. This is a ternary operator. This allows us to check. You can see we're using it right here. It's this question mark. Okay, it's a question mark. So what it does is checks this condition. Is n greater than 100? If it's true, it's the first thing is going to happen. So in this, the first piece of code is going to execute. So in this case, it's high. And if it's false, so if n is less than or equal to 100, it's going to execute the second piece of code, which is low. Okay, so if, for example, I put in n as 99, what would string s get set equal to? Shout it out. Low. Awesome. And if it were 101? Hi. Awesome. Everyone's awake.
So I'm going to make a comment about this. So ternary operator, it is very easy to use a ternary operator under any circumstance where, like, think of the alternative for this code. People would frequently say string s, semicolon. If n greater than 100, s equals high. Else, s equals low. So that format is very common, and in that case, you should always use a ternary operator. You're going from like five-ish lines of code to one line of code. And the other way I like to read this is think of the question mark as like literally asking a question. So is n greater than 100? Then high. And then read the colon as else, else low.
Cool. Any questions with that? Alrighty. OK, so we will jump into some more comfortable topics.
Okay, so I think you had to watch the video on this for the PSET, possibly, but we'll talk through this again. So the compilation process. Now, what actually happens when we run make? So let's remove everything in this directory. And I'll make a file, hello.c. It will just be your standard hello world. And hey, you have to implement hello world on the problem set, so I'm giving you the solution. Okay. So all this will do, we'll make it and run it just to make sure. Make hello dot slash hello. And we get hello world. Okay, nothing surprising. So now what's actually happening when we run make? Now, we see this command up here playing a whole bunch of flags. Remember from our man page adventures, all these things with dashes, those are flags to the command. So we're passing the dash ggdb3 flag. We're passing the dash o0 flag. And if you wanted to know more about these flags, you could man clang to see what that is, to see what those flags are. So now clang, make is itself. This is a common true and false question on exams. On quizzes. So make is not a compiler. Clang is the compiler. All make is doing is running some commands. In this case, it happens to be running exactly one command, but we could have a make file that runs a whole bunch of commands. Clang is a compiler. So it's Clang that's taking the file hello.c and outputting an executable file. So what's actually happening during this compilation process? So we saw first thing is this preprocessor step. So the preprocessor step affects pretty much everything that has a pound, a hash, in front of it. So you'll see hash defines in class, and you'll need to use them on your problem sets. We've already seen hash include. There are a whole bunch of others that we typically won't use in this class, like hash if will let you conditionally compile blocks of code. Now, If we wanted to just run the preprocessor, we can do clang dash E on hello.c, capital E. So boom, a whole bunch of stuff just came out to the screen. So that's not particularly helpful. What would be helpful is if I could output this to a file. So instead of outputting to the screen, I will pipe this into a file called hello2.c. And let's take a look at that file. Okay, so this is what hello2.c looks like. There's a whole bunch of stuff, typedef long int block size t, typedef struct IO file, typedef struct IO file to file, a whole bunch of stuff. Now, if I go down to the bottom near line 740, we see my original code, int main void, printf hello world. Okay, so what is all of this 730 something lines above? Yes. Yeah, so what was the only other thing in my original hello.c? If I look back at hello.c, I see hash include standard io.h. So all hash include does is blindly take the contents of standard io.h and paste them into the top of my file. So when the preprocessor runs, it's the preprocessor is what recognizes this hash include. It looks for hashes in your file. It sees hash include, grabs the standard io.h file and pastes it into the code into your code. So if we're looking at hello.2.c, all of this stuff, all of these 740 whatever lines are in standard io.h. That means standard io.h does all of these typedefs and declares all of these variables, where you'll see what typedef is soon, but standard io.h is doing a whole bunch of them for you. Okay, so that's preprocessing. That's the very first step. The preprocessor is very dumb. All it does is like blind copying and pasting or blind cutting of code. Now, yeah?
So in a way, if you only need one function out of standard io.h, or like cs50.h,
yeah.
It doesn't matter, because you're going to get it all.
Yeah, so if you only needed a single function from standard io.h, you are still going to get this entire header file pasted into your code. Now, that's not so bad, since once the header file doesn't contain any of the actual code, it just contains things like function declarations. So a function declaration, when it comes time to actually compile things, doesn't actually take up any space. It's only for the compilation process that we need to declare functions. There's no actual code involved. It's not in the ending file. And now, if you were in the prior super section, you saw that Davin did something like hash include helpers.c. And then in the end, we told you never to do this. So the only reason this worked for him is because this is just the preprocessor. It blindly took the file helpers.c and pasted its contents into the top of this file. That isn't how you're supposed to use multiple files. You're supposed to more intelligently use the compiler to put together multiple files. But Davin was using multiple files by just taking the contents of helpers.c and putting it at the top of this file. Okay? Questions on the preprocessor? All right, so the next step is the compiler. So this might be confusing that we have the compilation process. We have clang is a compiler, but then there's a compiler within the compiler. So all compiler means is taking higher level code and transforming it into lower level code. So that might also be confusing because you might think, well, C isn't particularly high level code. That said, you're transforming it into assembly code. Assembly is about as bare bones as you get. It's the exact instructions that your computer understands, that your CPU understands. So C is high level compared to assembly. Now, this also means that there are compilers that compile. It pretty much doesn't even have to be a high level language to a low level language. If there's a compiler that translates Python to C code, that's higher level, lower level, but that's a compiler. There's a compiler that might translate C to JavaScript. That's compiling it to another type of code. So that's what the compiler does. So now if we look at, let's get rid of helpers.c.
So then assembly code is just like
Not yet. We'll see what the assembly code looks like. I think the issue here is the internet, because this is currently fighting me. Okay. Let's refresh. If not, I'll just pull up an editor in my on my Mac. I might just do that. Okay. That's not what I wanted. Okay. Now. So everything I'm doing on here should be possible to do in Cloud9. It's just the internet connection. So I'll remake hello.c. Okay, make sure I didn't do anything wrong. By default, make in on my Mac is using CC. That's another simple, or that's another C compiler. I can explicitly use Clang, in which case the default, I didn't give it a name, but the default is a.out. Okay, so it still prints hello world. Now, remember dash E was how we did just the preprocessor. Now, if we want to run every, if we want to run the preprocessor and the compiler, then the flag we're going to pass is dash capital S. So Clang dash capital S hello.c gives us this file hello.s. I don't know why it's .s, maybe for assembly. That .a is taken for something else. It's an archive file. So dash s might just be for assembly. So looking at this file, we see a whole bunch of stuff that probably doesn't make any sense to you, unless you've seen assembly before. Now, if you take CS61, you will learn how to read a lot of this. But you're not going to learn how to read this in this course. But take it, let's see. OK, so right here, sub q. So we see this command sub q 16 from % RSP. You don't have to know what any of this means. Sub q is basically the most basic subtraction operation that you're, that the assembly code provides a subtraction operator. Move is basically assignment. So we're storing into this thing called %al the value 0. Call is how we can call a function. We're calling the printf function. Add, there's a basic add. So assembly, there's like a very bare bones set of functionality that assembly gives you. And this is what this looks like. Almost nobody actually codes in any assembly nowadays. That doesn't mean that it's not useful to be able to read the assembly output of a file, but you're definitely not going to be doing that in CS50. So this is what the assembly looks like. So now, what does the assembler do? So all the assembler does is takes the assembly and translates it to ones and zeros. There's a, if you give me an assembly file, I could do the translation to ones and zeros because there is an exact, like the sub q function or the sub q instruction has an exact binary representation that if I had a, like a table mapping sub q to the correct binary code, I could write it down. Now it would take me forever because it wouldn't even take me that long. I mean, there's only 32 lines in this file. So it wouldn't take me that long to translate this to the binary by hand. So that's all the assembler does. The assembler is also pretty dumb. I mean, the preprocessor just blindly copy pasted. The assembler is just blindly translating, is blindly taking sub q and putting it to ones and zeros. The compiler was really the smart thing. Okay, so that's all the assembler does. If we want to see that, we can do clang dash c, hello.c. And now we have this file hello.o, where .o stands for object file, and that contains just binary. If I try to open this in a text editor, I would see this. So this garbage, generally, you then know you just tried to open a binary file. So we happen to see somewhere in here, we see hello world. So somewhere in this file that happens to be hello world, but obviously that must have been somewhere because we're printing it. But otherwise, all of this is just those assemblies instructions translated to ones and zeros. And since I opened it in Vim, now Vim is trying to interpret this as ASCII, which we'll talk about ASCII in a bit. But Vim is trying to interpret this binary as characters, and it's just not characters. Okay, so that brings us to the object file. Now, the last step is the linker. So we have officially completely compiled hello.c, but the thing that's missing is the printf code. So if we looked at, looked at the assembly or at the object file, the .o file, we would see all of this code. This is all of the code that's related to hello.c itself. The part that's missing is right here, we call printf, but nowhere in here is the printf code. So printf is defined in the C library, and we just need to link to that code. Linking is how you combine different object files into one final executable. So linking, we had hello.o. Now we go and grab the code for printf, combine it with hello.o, and we end up with an actual executable file, which if I want to show that, all I need to say is make, clang hello.c. We will explicitly name the output file hello. Now that completely compiled it, including the printf code. And if we did ls-l, this right here is the size of the file. So notice hello.o was 828 bytes. Hello, the executable file, is 8,456 bytes. So the reason for the size increase is we needed to include printf. We needed to join printf to the hello function, or the hello object code. And that must have taken up a lot of memory. I mean, 8,000 bytes, that's very small, but compared to the 828 that hello.o used to be. Yes? So dash o hello, this just says name the output file. So if I removed both a.out and hello, now I just have hello.c, o, and s in this directory. If I do clang hello.c, the default file that it outputs is called a.out. So that's the same. This just says I want you to name the output file hello. I could have named it hello foo, and I have a file called hello foo. If you noticed, I can't go back to Cloud 9, but when you run make, that big clang command that it gives you, part of that clang command is this dash o hello. Yeah?
In this last line, is a.out the same as hello
underscore? Yep. And another nifty bash command is diff. So if we want to diff hello foo and a.out, we'd see that since nothing is outputted, that meant those files are identical. I can. Not hello.c. Let's do test one. We'll do dog, cat, fish. And test two, we'll just do dog, cat, or dog, fish. Now if we diff test one and test two, it would give us some output that if you, I don't even remember what this means, I think like line two, character one, there is cat in one of the files, but not in the other file. So diff is a way you can get the difference between two files. And since there was no output here, it meant the files were identical. Which I was then going to say one more thing. Oh, so instead of having to say diff test one, test two, I could have done diff test curly brace one, comma two, which would expand to test one, test two. Gives me the same thing. All right, any questions? And I think that's the whole compilation process. Now.
All right, so now that we have, now that we know how we get from our C code to binary, let's talk a little bit more about binary. So on the very first day of lecture, we saw these binary bulbs, which basically represent how information is stored in our computers. We have all of these little, basically on and off switches, ones or zeros, and that's just how we represent information. So some things we should keep in mind. If this usually comes up on quiz zero, how to add and subtract numbers in binary. Of course, one option would be to convert to decimal, which we're more used to working with, and then do the math and then convert back. But we can actually do this much more simply, just doing it in binary. So addition works exactly the way you'd expect it to, where you have 1 plus 1 becomes essentially 2, right? But 2 in binary is 1, 0. So you have to carry the 1. So the big thing to remember is don't forget to carry the 1. Similarly in subtraction, instead of carrying, you can, you know, if you don't, like, if you have 0 minus 1, of course, there's, you don't want to go negative, so you can borrow from the left, as we do in decimal. Any questions there? Yeah. Yeah, so, okay, so this is, like, not exactly lined up perfectly. I will try to fix that. But basically, okay, so suppose we're doing 0 here. So, no, I'm not going to try to write on the board. But suppose we're doing 1, 0, 0 minus 0, 1, 0. So we can do 0 minus 0 is 0. That's easy. And now if we have 0 minus 1, we can't do that. So what we want to do is borrow the 1 from over here. So essentially what we're doing is saying, okay, instead of the 0 here, we're going to replace it with this, we're going to borrow, make this 10, which is really what in decimal?
2,
okay. And then so 2 minus 1 is 1. Yeah, so it's just the way we borrow. We do the same thing with decimals where usually when we're borrowing, we say, okay, I'm going to take 10 over. Here we're taking 2 over.
So think if it were like, I don't know, 67 and we were subtracting 9, then we would take 1 from the 6 to bring that to a 5, and then we have 17. So the part where this gets somewhat confusing is the fact that, think if instead we were subtracting 107, and we were 107 and then we were subtracting 9, well, we need to take 1 from the 0, which causes that to go down to a 9, which that's why here, when we have to keep taking the 1 until we get to a, it works the same way, except the only numbers you have are 1 and 0 instead of 0 through 9.
So you can put a 2 if you want, if that makes it more
like
clear to you.
Mentally, you can put a 2.
But 2 doesn't exist in binary.
Yeah. So in your final result cannot have a 2.
But yeah, if you understand this better as, okay, 1, 0 is 2, then you can just write 2 in your head. Right.
But in binary, 10 minus 1 is 1.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Any other questions on this? Alrighty. So this leads us to the question, how can we represent negative 1?
Okay.
Back to Rob.
I will throw this guy up. Maybe that'll still be projected somewhere reasonable. Do it here for now. Hey, that ends up perfectly on that little bar. Okay, so throughout this, let's assume that we're representing numbers using 8 bits. So in C, you'll learn the sizes of various data types, but basically you can think char x equals, let's say, 1. So in C, the char data type, it doesn't have to be literally characters. All it means is that the char data type stores 8 bits. Now, that means that how do we represent x in binary? Get 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. Okay, that's nothing surprising. But now, how do we go about representing negative 1? Okay, so there are several ideas for how to go about this. These are some of them. There are others that are used in rare situations. Given the color highlighting, 2's complement is going to be the correct answer for our purposes. So first is signed magnitude. Now, what does that mean? Basically, it means we take this last bit and treat it as a sign bit. So when we want to represent negative 1, well, since this is 0, that's positive 1. If we want it to be negative 1, we'll just make it out of 1. That represents negative 1.
So that's very intuitive because, you know, in negative one in numbers, we usually just put the sign at the front. So here we're just putting the sign at the front. Now, this has at least one issue with it. I think it, well, can anyone give an issue with this? Yeah. Okay, so the first thing to note is as soon as we start embracing negative numbers, so technically in C, if we had said unsigned char x, then, well, first I couldn't say negative 1 to begin with, but the possible values for x would be 0 to 255. So it's, we have 8 bits, 2 to the 8th is 256, so it's 0 to 255 since we need to count 0 as one of the numbers. So there are 256 possibilities. As soon as we start embracing negative numbers, we are accepting the fact that we cannot get this many positive values. So in this scenario, we can only represent negative 127 to 127. Is this case without the unsigned. Okay? So, yes, as soon as we go, but no matter what we do, as soon as we go to signed numbers, we lose a range of positive values. Okay, so one potential issue with this is what does this number represent? So this represents negative zero, which is a weird concept. If we just blindly compared negative zero to positive zero, then it would probably return false, even though fundamentally they're both zero. So this is a complication. It would mean every single time we do an equality check, we would need to first check, well, is this zero? In which case, so that's a weird thing. Now, let's talk about the next one for a second, and then we'll talk about another problem, but I don't remember the exact problem, so I'll talk about it in vague terms. One's complement. So one's complement would instead, let's go back to we started with, this is the binary for one. Now the binary for negative one would be just flip all the bits. So 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 0. That would be negative one. And now that means that the most negative number would be 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. So this would be like 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, which would be 127. Flip all the bits, we get negative 127, which would be this. So this is negative 1. This is negative 127. Now, does anyone see the problem with this version of things? So we actually have the same exact problem. How do we represent 0, all zeros? Then when we flip the bits, we get all ones, which would still represent 0. So we still have this issue with two representations of 0. That's the additional issue that I can't really, I don't remember which one's which, but if we worked through the math, we would have found it out. Some of these have issues with addition, where it isn't as simple as just adding the numbers together. The result isn't the correct answer. You have to do a bit more math. So I think it's one's complement that has weird math. Okay? And you can't just do the same way you would do in decimal. It wouldn't just work if you did that, if you added negative one to one. Okay, so now 2's complement. How does 2's complement work? Well, you take 1's complement and you add 1. So if this is the 1's complement representation of negative 1, then the 2's complement representation of negative 1 is this. Now, a better way of understanding it is instead of This is kind of like a sign bit, except it still carries the weight of its position. So it's not like signed magnitude, where this just indicates positive or negative. Instead, this would represent negative 2 to the 8th, whereas the rest of the bits are 2 to the 7th, 2 to the 6th, 2 to the 5th, and so on. So how does this help us? Well, let's first consider the binary 100000. Okay, so what decimal value does that represent? Negative 2 to the 7th, right? 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Forgot we start from 0. And then down to 0. Okay, so the binary 1 followed by all zeros, what decimal value does that represent? Yeah, it's negative 128. So 100000 is negative 128. So now 100000001 would be negative 127. And so really how we're accomplishing negative numbers is we have the first bit representing a big negative number, and then the rest of the bits add back. So what would this binary represent? 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. So the easy way of getting these sorts of numbers are they're just 2 to the 7th minus 1. Because 2 to the 7th would be 100000, subtracting 1, you get 0, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. So this is 127. And this actually shows that in 2's complement, you can represent the range of values negative 128 all the way up to 127. Some people find that weird that we have more negative numbers than we do positive numbers, but that's just the way it works. Do you have a question? Yes, negative 127 would be 100000001. So now what would negative 1 be? Negative 1 would be what we said over here, 1111111111, because we have the first bit set, this big negative 128, and then the rest of the bits add back to it 127 times, and we end up with negative 1. So this representation, I mean, except for this last bit, this is everything you expect with positive numbers. And now adding this last bit is how 2's complement works. And it has nice properties with addition. It doesn't have two representations of zero. Everything is nice. Okay? Any other questions about 2's complement? All right. So next thing, integer overflow. Now let's consider, I need another piece of chalk. Let's get this guy. So now let's move into the world of just working with 4 bits. So there is no C data type that would give me just 4 bits, but 8 bits is too many. So working with just 4 bits, okay, how do we do addition of 0001 and 0010? Well, this is easy. So let's still assume we're working in 2's complement. So this is technically a negative, but both of these numbers are positive. So 0001 plus 0010, don't even have to do any carrying or anything. It's just 0011. Okay. So this is 1 plus, in decimal, this is 1 plus 2 is 3. Nothing surprising. Okay, so what if instead we did 0, 1, 0, 0 plus, let's actually just do it again. So 0, 1, 0, 0 is 4 plus 0, 1, 0, 0. Is it forcibly cut in 5 minutes or?
No, just wrap up.
Okay, yeah. 0100 plus 0100. This is 4 plus 4. So doing blind binary addition,
We get this carry the one, so this becomes zero. We get 1000. Now, what does this number represent in decimal? So it's not eight. Well, if you remember that I said still go with 2's complement. This is negative 8. So we went from 4 plus 4 equals negative 8. So this is integer overflow. The issue, remember our range is, so given just 4 bits, our range is going to go from negative 8 to 7. So if we try to add 4 plus 4, you wrap back around to the other side and you end up with negative 8. You can do the same thing the other way, where if we tried to do like negative 4 minus negative 5, we'd wrap back around and end up at 7, I think. So everyone understand that? This is just a consequence of we have a limited number of bits to deal with this addition. And actually, yeah, that's fine. Any questions? So ASCII.
Right, awesome. So we not only want to represent numbers using binary, but since we have to keep everything in our computer in ones and zeros, we're also going to want to represent things like letters. So that's where something called ASCII comes in. So we have this nice table that essentially maps numbers to characters and a bunch of other symbols that we might want to represent on our computer. So for example, I know this chart is super tiny, but you can see that capital A is 65. So if we wanted to represent A on our computer, we would say, okay, well, A corresponds to 65, and then we could put 65 in binary, which we know how to do, and store that on our computer. Similarly, we have a lowercase a that's going to correspond to 97, and we can store it like that. So of course, you don't need to memorize this chart. This is something you can reference when you need to. All right. Having said that you don't need to memorize this chart, hopefully you remembered those two numbers I just said. Let's just do a little bit of practice with this. Because since we have this nice mapping between characters and numbers, that means that we can actually do some math that includes both characters and numbers. So for example, we have the first statement. We're going to print. Does anyone remember what the percent I will print? An integer. Okay, so we're looking. Our answer is going to be an integer or a number. And we want to do the character capital A plus 1. So does anyone remember what I said character capital A corresponds to? 65. Cool. And then we just add 1. 66. So this is just going to print out 66. All right, for the second one, we said that lowercase a So percent C, what do you think that prints out? A character this time. Okay, so our answer is going to be a character. And we're going to say, okay, what is lowercase a minus uppercase a? Well, lowercase a corresponds to 97 minus 65. Okay, and then we're going to add 65 back. So that's just going to be 97. So what should this print? Lowercase a. Beautiful.
So this just goes back to what I was saying, that a char is not inherently needed to represent a character. When I declare a variable char x, that just means I want an 8-bit variable. So if I wanted, I could say int x equals 65, and then try to print int x as a percent c, and it would print capital A. So there's nothing inherent to char about being an ASCII character. It's all about the way you try to interpret the binary. So in the first case, we're interpreting the binary as a number, and in the second case, we're interpreting the binary as an ASCII code.
Cool. Any questions with that? Alrighty. So here are just some other types that we'll encounter: integers, floats, doubles, longs. These will come up a little bit later. And last but not least, we have a little bit on floating point imprecision.
Is that me? So just the quick point this out, he mentions it in class, but 1.0 divided by 10.0. So ideally this would give us 1/10, it would give us 0.1. But in binary, we can't really represent 0.1 very precisely. Now think of the values we typically represent in binary. We can represent like 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2, and we can add those things together. So when we start getting to floating point values, we maintain that same idea, except we get to like 2 to the negative 1, 2 to the negative 2, 2 to the negative 3. So we can precisely represent 0.5 and 0.25 and 0.75, since that's 0.5 plus 0.25, but we can't represent 0.1, since there's no combination of a finite number of bits that can add up to exactly 0.1. So print answer to 20 decimal places. If we did this, we would see that it would print something like, I don't know, 0.99999999972 or whatever, because that's just the closest it can get in the finite number of bits that we have to represent 0.1. So how are they stored? You can look up the floating point standard. It's basically, we are storing it in two parts. We store the mantissa, where that's, think of it as like a scientific notation, except for in binary terms. So really, this would be an exponent in terms of 2. But we store in two parts, the mantissa and the exponent, and that's how we are representing floating point numbers. You don't need to know integers. You need to know the binary representation. We would never tell you to know the binary representation of a given floating point value. Last thing we want to point out is if you took APCS, a lot of this stuff will map to some of your Java knowledge. So in Java, we had a compiler called Java C. That's equivalent to the compiler Clang. That outputs a class file, a bytecode file. That's pretty much equivalent to the .o file, the object code file that we output. Now, the part that differs is in Java, we have the JVM that runs on top of whatever machine we're on. And so the JVM is sort of the point that's missing. In C, the case is the compiler is translating one version for Windows, one version for Linux, and one version for Mac. Each operating system has its own compiler to compile the C code down to object code for that specific operating system. But otherwise, the compilation ideas are the same. Any questions about anything today? All right, good luck with the PSET, and we'll see you soon.